Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
On iHeart and on Odyssey. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So President Biden's big guy's big speech yesterday on voting rights. And if you thought Jen Psaki was being hyperbolic previous day, we played her comments working off of the script yesterday that this was the greatest challenge to our democracy since the Civil War. The big guy went one step further. It's apparently even a bigger challenge than the Civil War after he made mention that the Confederates never breached the Capitol as insurrectionists did on January 6th.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. I'm still processing that. I don't even want to call it a speech. I don't know what the heck that was. That was a bunch of hyperbole and bull jive. I mean, listen to this ABC reporter real quick. Just listen.
The president saying new laws in more than 16 states are part of a painful pattern aimed at denying minorities and women the right to vote.
Right. I'm a woman. Am I denied the right to vote? Are minorities denied the right to vote? Are you kidding me? He should be ashamed. He's a lying sack of you know what.
This.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I don't know that this requires comment to those who are able to assimilate the obvious. The whole discussion of Jim Crow and the Civil War and denying people the right to vote and the federal election takeover legislation that's pending is about the right to vote and it's about preserving our democracy. I'd like to crawl into the mind of someone on the left who, when they hear this dreck, they shake their heads. Yeah. I'm part of something important.
But there are people that are like that.
I know. They're called Texas state legislators, Democratic Texas state legislators. And they were at the Capitol, too, welcomed by Reparation H, who, by the way, has been designated for yet another job. She's point on this bad boy.
It's clear for those who challenge the results and question the integrity of the election, no other election has ever been held under such scrutiny and such high standards. Time and again, we've weathered
the big lie,
the right to vote in free and fair elections. And each time we found a way to overcome. And that's what we must do today. Vice President Harris and I have spent our careers doing this work, and I've asked her to lead, to bring people together to protect the right to vote and our democracy. And it starts with continuing the fight to pass H.R. 1, the For the People Act.
There you go.
For the people.
If you like what Reparation H. did at the border, then you're going to love what she has in store for voting rights, preserving our democracy, so on and so forth. And here was her rolling out the red carpet for those Texas Democrat state legislators
who were drunk on Miller Lite,
who abdicated.
So I wanted to stop by to say hello, to say welcome, and to say thank you.
Oh, God.
You all know I've been traveling, and as most recently as yesterday when I was in Detroit and heard of your courageous stand, I talked about exactly what I believe about the courage and the commitment and the patriotism that you all have evidenced by your actions in addition to your work and your words. And I know what you have done comes with great sacrifice, both personal and political. And you are doing this in support and in defense of some of our nation's highest ideals. Reporters ask me, well, you know, what do you think about the issue? I say, look, defending the right of the American people to vote is as American as apple pie.
Yeah.
Oh, that is sickening. They need to shut their mouths and they need to go back to work because Texans don't run. Texans.
Okay.
No, come on. I lived in Texas. It's a different country.
Yeah, these are the Democrat socialists in Texas.
Yeah, well,
these Democrat socialists.
They sacrifice.
Oh,
they're singing.
We notes. Will overcome.
I like when they sing drums.
We will overcome someday. Deep in my heart, I do believe we will overcome someday.
It's a little lethargic,
thank you, Steve.
Too. Yeah. That
that's the drunk wonderful. Ones after they got off the plane, because they sing it twice. They sing it, you know, when they got off the plane and then yesterday.
These are modern-day freedom riders, these Texas Democrat state legislators.
Well, we're under attack.
No matter what, you can never stop the American people from voting. They will decide.
Is that in controversy?
Is it in controversy that minorities and women are being suppressed when it comes to voting? Are you kidding me? I mean, if you look at the Texas law, it allows more time for people to vote than before. More time. Hello. Such grandstanding.
Yeah. Again, I don't know. I have difficulty tackling this aspect of the election administration topic because I just don't know who listens to that and takes it seriously. I don't know who listens to that and thinks that this is anything other than, you know, cheap theatrics from the political stunt. And that's obviously what it is. The Texas Democrat state legislators, they can't stay out of Texas forever.
No. When they get back, Governor Abbott said they're going to be arrested.
Yeah, well, that's silly. And Abbott shouldn't have said that. It's ridiculous. But from that stunt to that rhetoric over the last 2 days from Psaki and Harris and Biden, who are these people?
Well, they're there. I mean, Mayor Lightfoot, when I asked her again about Keegan Castile, he's an Iowa guy who was here, who's not a mass shooter, who was here in Chicago. No, I'm just saying, I'm giving you an example. I asked her about that. Do you want to apologize to him, a rush to judgment? And she doubled down, and the people cheered and were clapping. So there are people out there that believe anything Democratic politicians say. And they don't care about the facts. They really don't.
Jordan in Forest Park.
Yeah, you know, it's really kind of ridiculous that, presenting an ID is such a terrible thing. But you know what? I think the Democrats, in order to be consistent, they ought to just right now say, you know what? Banks can no longer require you to show an ID, or maybe when you're using a credit card at a business, sometimes they ask for ID just to check. If that should be against the law, and people like Elizabeth Warren maybe ought to be out there right now saying banks can no longer require an ID to make it consistent.
Thanks for the call, Jordan. Well, again, you know, we're talking about a constitutional right versus a privilege with respect to IDs. But what I would say is, yeah, right, exactly. So that's a constitutional right. You don't think it should require an ID as a safeguard. Okay. So let's certainly advocate that this be the cultural norm. No identification for anything. Constitutional rights or privileges of living in a free society. No one. You know, let's lead the way in making sure that everybody can do everything anonymously. Without verification. Bill in Lincoln Park.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. Those people that got on a plane and acted like that, I mean, politicians 20, 30 years, 40, 50 years ago, I doubt that they wouldn't even think of doing that. It just wouldn't happen. And, I mean, my gosh, what I saw, I mean, I've seen people, kids going to Florida on spring break acting more mature. Secondly, this thing keeps coming off with this 9/11 thing. I mean, storming the Capitol was worse than 9/11. I've served overseas with guys that are firemen and policemen in the New York area, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Jersey. And that right now on Facebook, I mean, I stay in touch with a lot of their parents, with their wives or their kids, and even a lot of those guys. And they are, they have relatives even and friends that they knew that went down on those twin towers on 9/11. Boy, they are inflamed. They are burned up about that. I mean, so that's all I'd have to say.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Appreciate it. Well, you know, Bill, Confederates never breached the Capitol. 9/11.
I mean,
Lincoln, the Lincoln Project types, for all you Never Trumpers, Lincoln Project types like Steve Schmidt, making the case that 1/6 was worse than 9/11. Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I thought that in President Biden's remarks, the comment that he made about who was counting the votes is what matters. And boy, he couldn't have said anything more clearly. I think, you know, they don't care who votes, it's who's counting. And, you know, that's a big telltale sign as far as their bill that they want to pass.
Thanks for the call, Mark.
And then his, you know, Biden's call to action for people.
Stand up for God's sake and help prevent this concerted effort to undermine our election and the sacred right to vote. Have you no shame?
Have you no shame, in quoting Joseph Welch saying, have you no shame?
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about big guy Biden's big lie. It was about, 45 minutes worth of it yesterday in Philadelphia as he tried to rally the nation to put pressure on Senate Republicans to move the federal takeover of elections in this country.
Yeah, and Senate Democrats need the support of 10 Republicans, and that's not going to happen.
This was attended by Texas Democrat Socialist state legislators who were in the minority in both the House and the Senate in Texas. So as everybody knows now, they fled to D.C. to put pressure on the Senate so they don't have to go back to Texas empty handed. The plan for those Democrat Socialists, if you're wondering how long are they going to be in absentia, until August 7th, the expiration of the special session that Governor Abbott called for the purposes of moving election reform legislation. But of course, as Abbott responded, well, I can just keep calling special sessions. They can't stay forever. And even some of those Democrat Socialist state legislators from Texas that were interviewed on the usual places, MSNBC and CNN, conceded, yeah, we're here to try to put pressure on the Senate. We're here to, you know, engage in the histrionics and get feted by Reparation H as they did yesterday and so on and so forth. But ultimately, this is the only way out of this for us is if the federal government intercedes where and prevents Texas from passing election reform legislation. If the federal government does indeed take over the rule of law on elections in the country.
Federal voting rights law.
Armando Martinez is one of those Democrat socialists from Texas. Hey, this is not a stunt. This is something
real.
Else. I don't know.
So you can't stay out of Texas forever. With Republicans in the majority, the bill that is being discussed, it will very likely get passed. If this is the eventual reality, do you acknowledge that what you all are doing is a stunt?
I don't think that it's a stunt. I think we've used the rules to our benefit. I think Democrats, once again, are very resilient and have come out ahead in utilizing anything that we have available placed on the table in order to address this. I think it's something that we will continue to look at ways that we can address this issue, especially with voting rights. And the fact that we as Democrats are doing this in a way to not only for party affiliation, not only for socioeconomic status, it's for everybody. And voting rights is extremely important. So Democrats are going to do everything available to us in order to make sure that we address voting rights and democracy within Texas.
I don't know. Do you like this abdication more or less than when Wisconsin Democrat Socialists fled Madison for the Clock Tower Hotel in Rockford because they didn't want to allow Scott Walker's budget repair bill to be passed? And that was the greatest threat since the Civil War up there in Wisconsin
and
for 5 minutes.
Yeah, and we're going to have Scott Walker on tomorrow, by the way.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's interesting. So Democrats, Socialists in Madison flee when they don't have the votes. Democrats, Socialists in Texas flee when they don't have the votes. And what are you treated to? Well, obviously, the identitarian race hustle as the cover story. Here's a smattering.
We took a stand and we left the state of Texas because that was the best and the right thing to do at the right time.
I am tired of sitting as a hostage in a House of Texas House of Representatives while Republicans strip away the rights of my constituents to vote.
We have courage, conviction, and a little bit of defiance. And we're here today to rally the nation, and we hope that the U.S. Senate will hear us.
Mm. And Chuck Schumer did.
Keep in mind, people, that this new Texas Voting Act allows more time than previously for people to vote. More time. Hello. Yeah, it eliminates 24-hour voting and drive-through and certain things, but it's not suppressing minorities and women's right to vote.
I think it prohibits, doesn't it? Doesn't
I mean,
it prohibit?
Am I under attack? I didn't know. Did somebody
Understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is that women and minorities are not allowed to vote in Texas. Is that correct?
That's what Biden said yesterday. I mean, I have to play it again. I'm sorry.
The president saying new laws in more than 16 states are part of a painful pattern aimed at denying minorities and women the right to vote.
Yeah, right. It's Jim Crow.
Yeah, 21st century Jim Crow. That's what he said yesterday.
That's what he's been saying since he was elected. George in Elk Grove Village. Hey, George.
Hey, George. Turn your radio down.
George.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah.
Good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. Perhaps Governor Abbott should apply some of the lefty principles for voting and take it to his state legislature. You know, he could have a no ID absentee ballot, or he could just simply harvest the votes, or you know, harvest their vote because they're not there.
Yeah, right. Thanks for the coach. The Republican legislature should harvest, should do some ballot harvesting in the state legislature there. Remember, the state legislature there in Texas is one of the reasons it works. The state meets only once every 2 years. They pass two-year budgets, and these legislators get only stipends and apparently private jet rides to D.C. as part of it as well.
But taxpayer money.
But, I mean, this is a legislature that does not have – it's not like a permanent political class the way we're used to it here in Illinois. So it's just interesting. The other thing is you can impeach legislators there, or you move impeachment through a simple majority vote. So I don't know. I mean, if this persists, Republicans, since Democrats are using every tool available, Republicans could use every tool available too. Forget this arresting business. Just move to impeach them. You have control of both chambers in Texas. Vote your shares.
Why don't you like the fact that Governor Abbott wants to arrest him?
Because there's no basis for it.
Once they step back into the state of Texas, they will be arrested and brought to the Texas Capitol, and we will be conducting business.
Yeah, I don't know that there's any legal basis for it. And what is the arrest? You know, arresting legislators. If they want to flee, if they want to abrogate their duty, then this is a political matter. It's not a criminal one. It's not a legal one. It's over the top. So, you know, the one of the reasons that Abbott is getting primary challenges, including from Colonel Allen West, is he's been a little squishy over the last couple of years, particularly with respect to COVID policy, but on other matters as well. And now that he's facing this challenge and he's up for re-election for a third term next year, he's really trying to amp up his activity on these very important issues like border security or election reform. And he's, it's a little bit over the top. You dial it down. You don't respond to hyperbole with hyperbole. You respond to hyperbole and histrionics and political stuntery with sobriety.
Right. I mean, criminally, what would they be arrested for? You're right. I mean, there's...
When he says arrested, what he's basically saying, they'll be compelled to...
Go back to the legislature, go back to the House.
But, I mean, look, I'll just keep calling special sessions. The federal government's going to do what it's going to do. We're going to do what we're going to do in Texas. And, you know, make it a referendum question for Texas Democrats or for the Texas electorate on Texas Democrat Socialists. That's what you do in this. Will and Skokie.
Hey, how you doing? You know, with all these lies flying around, first of all, whenever you hear a politician say democracy, hold on to your wallets. It's basically, we're not a democracy. We're a constitutional republic.
Yeah.
Second of all, if you want pure democracy, look and see what happened to that building collapse down in Florida where you had the condo board, half of which didn't even live in the building, and the they were making the decisions even though they had no clue what the hell they were doing. That's what's happening here. You're noticing, I saw five or six different articles about various groups. One was a poverty group that's going to Washington and pushing for this voting rights thing, or this House Bill 1, Senate Bill 1, because, you know, it saves democracy and it'll take care of poverty. It has nothing to do with poverty. Why doesn't someone get up and actually say to Biden, look, give me an example of how this suppresses things?
Yeah, well, thanks for the call. I mean, didn't we just go through this with the Georgia election reform law? I guess we're still going through it. But, you know, we went through that chapter and verse. There's no talking to people that are going to make statements like we're facing the most significant threat to our democracy since the Civil War.
21st century Jim Crow assault.
They're not interested in any sort of thoughtful conversation or conversation on the merits any more than those corporations that threw in with the hysterics on the left were interested in looking at the Georgia election law and comparing it to, say, oh, I don't know, Delaware's election law, New York's election law, to see, you know, which is more regulatory, which is more strident than the other. I mean, there's just no talk. How do you have a conversation about with people who say we're facing the most significant threat to our democracy since the Civil War, with people who say January 6th was worse than 9/11. January 6th was worse than the Civil War, is what Joe Biden essentially said yesterday. The Confederates never breached the Capitol.
And that minorities and women are, we don't have the right to vote
like
we used to.
Suppressing the vote.
My God.
Everybody is being, but first of all, everybody is being treated equally, obviously, under these election reform laws.
Right.
Otherwise, they would be, that would be prima facie unconstitutional. These laws would be.
Well, then you and I would be upset if they were suppressing the right to vote for minorities and women.
So it is infantilizing their constituents, which is what they do. You're my dependent. You're my child. We're going to oppose this because it makes things more difficult for you, or at least that's what we're going to say. And what we really want is free reign to do what we want. And now we want to strip the power of states to and localities to manage their elections and federalize it, like we want to federalize everything, because we believe in direct democracy, not federalism. And if we're not a constitutional republic, really, although we believe in, yeah, it actually is kind
state
of
rights for a reason.
Interesting. They're anti-federalists. But they more believe like in a constitutional monarchy where the entire political class in D.C. is the monarchical class. That's sort of their position, it seems to me. Anthony and Darian.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy.
Morning.
I'd like to recommend Governor Abbott, when the Democrats get back to Texas, make sure they don't get lost again. They could put on Tom Dart's ankle monitoring program.
It's a good idea. Yeah, very good. Thanks for the call, Anthony. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Too soon.
Look how well the monitoring works here. So it'll keep track of them. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks, Dan and Amy, for taking my call. Always good talking to you. I missed the speech yesterday, so after your program ends today, I'll probably watch it and punish myself on YouTube.
It's a long 45 minutes, Bob.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was 36 when I looked it on YouTube. But I did catch a lot of the conservative media review of it. But I was watching, I think it was Ingraham last night that had Newt Gingrich on. And Gingrich says he actually agrees with Biden. This was the worst thing that happened to since the Civil War. But then he put the caveat on, if the Democrats get their way, this is the end of democracy.
Okay, thanks for the call, Bob. He didn't say this is the worst thing since the war. He said we're facing the most significant test of our democracy since the Civil War. Right. And if Newt Gingrich agrees with that, then he's wrong. And he's, I mean, wildly wrong, because that is a ridiculous statement. You want to go chapter and verse through the last 170 years of American history and talk about what is worse than 1-6? What is worse than the Civil War? What were the greatest challenges since the Civil War? I mean, are you kidding?
Come on. It's beyond laughable.
Tom in Deer Park.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, we've got a Republican Party that's devolved into populism, conspiracy theories, and a cult. But then the Democrats. You're a Democrat in Wisconsin, you flee to Illinois. You're a Democrat in Texas, you flee to D.C. I'm so confused. I like to put it to you, Dan and Amy. Where's a guy like me? Where should I go?
Where should you flee?
Where should I go?
Thanks for the call. I don't know. Florida, Southwest Florida, like
Indiana,
like everybody else. Yeah, Indiana. It's a good option. Northwest Indiana, Southwest Florida seem to be the popular areas. By the way, since Biden talked about counting votes, I did want to get to this. Arizona Senate President Karen Fan on the Maricopa County vote audit. She did a interview with a local radio host out there in John McCain land. His name, Mike Broomhead. And here's what she had to say about the vendor that they retained to do this audit. And this is sort of a first time in American history type of audit. And the Maricopa County vote totals, what the county got. And again, there's all of the proper qualifications that she offers, but this is being decried as also a threat to our democracy. Checking the count in Maricopa County is a threat to our democracy.
We are finishing up, the vendor is finishing up what we call the aggregation, double-checking the spreadsheets against the blue tally sheets, against the scans they did on the ballots, because before we turn those ballots back to Maricopa County, they want to make sure that every one of those check and balances match before they start doing the analysis of all the data they received. And a question came up a couple of weeks ago from our attorney and said, so what if Maricopa County's ballots are count is X and the vendor's count is Y, and we turn those ballots back, how do we know which one is really correct if there is a difference there? Because we won't have those possession of those ballots anymore. So that's when we said, let's get a couple of our own independent machines in, not Dominion's, separate ones, and do our own independent, and all we're doing is just counting the number of ballots. It's a paper counting machine is all it does.
So
that will help us give like a third check and balance to see if those numbers are closer to the vendor's numbers or Maricopa County's, or they all three could be right on target.
So was there a discrepancy between the numbers that the county said they had and the numbers that were counted by the cyber ninjas? Was there a discrepancy?
They haven't released a number yet, if you will. However, we do know that those numbers do not match with Maricopa County at this point.
Oh. You know, we talked about this before, and with all of the restraint that is appropriate, to say, well, what happens if now that all of the people who voted have been recorded as having voted by election authorities in Maricopa County and most of the rest of the nation? What happens if you come up with a different count in terms of total ballots cast versus the number of people checked in the election authorities' database as having voted. And how do you reconcile that? You know, there's also this issue in Georgia, too. I know people aren't paying attention, and to even have this conversation is to be some sort of conspiracy theorist or person promoting a big lie, because we're infants and we can't have conversations on the merits about these things. We have a characterization of anything in this category as the big lie. It's just like any opposition to the federal takeover of elections is you're promoting the new Jim Crow. We just have these labels that are placed on things because people don't feel the need to make arguments. And usually those people don't feel the need to make arguments, so the people who are unable to make arguments. Georgia, too, Margo Cleveland in The Federalist was distilling this. Perhaps as many as 35,000 people were not eligible to vote. We talked about this a bit yesterday with Ken Cuccinelli. And 35,000 people in question in terms of their residency to be able to vote in the November, November 2020 election, and maybe as many as round numbers, 10,000 votes were illicit in a state that Trump lost by 12,000 votes. This is not about changing the election results. This is about some theory about Trump is going to be reinstalled as president of the United States. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with what happened and what should be, if anything improper did, and what should be done to make it less likely improper things happen going forward in 2022 and beyond.
But the longer you have people vote, the more vulnerable the system is. I mean, can we ever go back to Election Day being Election Day and absentee and mail-in ballots for people who need it? Instead of just mail, if you're a registered Democrat in Illinois, you were mailed a ballot.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, right. Look, you know, government is always expanding. Government is always spending more. It's always expanding its footprint. It's always creeping its mission forward. And so this is sort of the same thing when it comes to election. Everybody starts from the premise, we want 100% participation. We want everybody to vote. And so we should always be striving to make things as easy as possible for everybody to vote.
But we changed the way we did an election because of COVID.
Well, I
and now they want to keep those, you know, initiatives in place forever.
And again, going back to Maricopa County, something else Karen Fan said, too, about Republicans and Democrats. Some Republicans and Democrats in Maricopa County blocking this check, this audit, every step of the way.
This is the first of its kind. And despite all of the hurdles, I mean, Maricopa County has not cooperated at all. They still haven't turned over things that they were supposed to in the subpoena. They have done everything in their power to try and stop this. Then we have, of course, Katie Hobbs, Adrian Fontes, the Democrat Party that has done everything in their ability to try and stop us, taking us to court, suing us over things. It's been a difficult challenge, but we are persevering on this.
Mm-hmm. And again, why so disagreeable, Maricopa County politicians? I mean, this is the opportunity, right? This is the opportunity to, we gave them everything that we were required to under subpoena. We let them look at everything. We let them do their own count. And here's at the end of the day what they came up with. So all of that talk was exactly what we said. This election was as pristine as elections can be. It's the most scrutinized election. There was no problems, no systemic problems, no structural problems, nothing endemic. It was a clean, fair election. And here is for the world to see. And so further marginalizing the position of anybody who suggests there was anything untoward afoot. Isn't that the strongest position you could be in? I'm so confident in what we did that I'm willing to have it on the 6 o'clock news. Come one, come all. Look at whatever you want. We're not going to let you manipulate anything, but look at whatever you want. You know, you want to see the ballots? Here are the ballots. You want to count the ballots? Count the ballots to your heart's content. I mean, isn't that the position that would exude confidence and also minimize any arguments to the contrary, as opposed to leaving questions unanswered or refusing to entertain questions. I just find the whole thing remarkable, and the Maricopa County audit is part and parcel of this larger conversation about the left and some so-called Republicans, their unwillingness to entertain legitimate questions.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, since we're talking about our democracy or representative republic, since we're talking about free and fair elections, we're talking about living in a free society, let's talk about freedom. Let's talk about freedom in Cuba. Cuba Libre. This perspective from a Cuban pastor on why Cubans are protesting. Oh, it's because of COVID. No, it's not. This is circulating online. I make this announcement appealing to pastors, prophets, evangelists, and leaders in general to pray for the city. It is in complete collapse due to the virus. There are people dying in the hallways, dying in the shelters. There's no medicine. There's nothing to give them. We're in total crisis and complete collapse as has never been seen before. I ask for the prayers of all men and women of God if you can focus completely on this city. We're praying continuously here in the city, and continual intercession and other ministries have also united in prayer. No medicine, no ventilators, no oxygen, no antibiotics. I tell you the truth. What they're reporting on television, the news, is not accurate. There's much more. We're in the middle of a total crisis, and the country's not responding. The country is not responding. The government is not responding. The doctors are dumbfounded. They don't know what they're going to do. There's a lot of fear and a lot of pride, a lot of pride. They don't want to seek help from other countries for medicine. I ask you to please pray, intercede, and go to battle with prayer for those in other provinces who have not experienced this. We're in the middle of a crisis. And then he just concludes, God bless you. I hope that you will make this announcement public so everyone can be praying. So, yes, COVID is a part of it, but COVID is a manifestation of the underlying healthcare system in Cuba, as well as the opportunity, the conduit for all of the other legitimate grievances that an oppressed people have. And so it's bubbled over.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. I know the mayor of Miami, you know, what should we do? He thinks possibly bombing Cuba might help.
That option is one that has to be explored and cannot be just simply discarded as an option that is not on the table. And there's a variety of ways the military can do it, but that's something that needs to be discussed and needs to be looked.
Yeah, I don't know about a bombing campaign in Havana, but you've seen the Cuban government's response.
And they're arresting people.
Troops.
They're arresting journalists.
Paramilitary groups unleashed on civilians. Cuban dissidents Guillermo Farinas, former political prisoner Jose Daniel Ferrer, artist Luis Manuel Otero Alcantara have been arrested, along with at least 190 others, according to some reports. The whereabouts of some are not known.
Yep.
Yeah, because that's what totalitarian regimes do, is they disappear you if you stick your head up.
I mean, do you think it's time to free Cuba?
Time to free Cuba? What do you mean? What do you mean, is it time to free Cuba?
I mean, is it time for a coup d'etat or an uprising?
Well, I hope so, but that has to, a coup d'etat has to come
from
internally. I don't think it's going to be external. I don't know that we're going to try to do Bay of Pigs part two.
But why is the Biden administration so silent? All they've done, the HHS secretary came out and said, "No, if you're from Haiti, Cuba, we will arrest you if you try and come here."
Well, not be allowed to enter the country.
Right. I don't want people getting in boats and trying to get over here.
Even if asylum settlers establish fear of persecution, they will be resettled in third countries, according to DHS Secretary Mayorkas. Well, that's an interesting posture from the open borders crowd.
Right.
So we always provide for asylum seekers. And I thought the waiting in Mexico policy pending your asylum application was inhumane. But for Cubans, for example, if they seek asylum for fear of political persecution, which there's a lot of evidence to support those asylum claims, at least for some, then they get resettled in a third country pending the asylum application. What's the difference? Why would Cubans be treated? Why would the administration take this posture with respect to Cubans, a posture different than they take, at least rhetorically, with respect to migrants coming up through Mexico? Huh. Gosh. Maybe Mark Hemingway has it right. I guess they don't think Cubans will vote Democratic. Yeah.
Oh.
Obviously. Julia Ioffe, however you pronounce her name, she's a reporter. She used to be with The Atlantic. I don't follow her because she's vacuous, but she's a good representation of the D.C. press corps. This has nothing to do with America's partisan fights. This is about people demanding freedom and dignity because they lack it. That's such an interesting approach you're hearing from the left when it comes to Cuba, much like you heard from the left when it came to Venezuela after that was an economic miracle in 2014. And now you have a migratory crisis in that part of South America as millions of Venezuelans have fled to neighboring countries, not to mention a humanitarian crisis with the starvation and so forth. And when that happens, when how central planning works out in the real world presents itself, what do you hear from reporters like Julia? It has nothing to do with America's partisan fights. Oh, of course not. No, of course not. But I guess that prompts the question. So the people, this is about people demanding freedom and dignity because they lack it. Well, what's the philosophy of those people in charge of the country that have denied the freedom and dignity the Cuban people deserve as human beings? Does that have anything to do with it? Does the ideology of Hugo Chavez and Maduro after him, does it have anything to do with the denial of freedom and dignity in Venezuela for the Venezuelan people? Is there any connection you can make? I love when the sort of soft walking Democrat socialists in this country look around at repressive regimes that collapse in on themselves, who share the same philosophy, they're just a little bit further down the road to serfdom, and say, this has nothing to do with what we're talking about in America. This has nothing to do with anybody's particular philosophy. Somehow, some way, the Cuban people have been denied their freedom and dignity. We don't know. No idea. How'd this happen? It's nobody's fault. It's just the way somehow things came to be in Cuba and Venezuela and everywhere else our ideas are tried. Joe in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I'm just really, really confused. I thought Bernie Sanders and all the leftists told us that, you know, we have to emulate Cuba because they are the epitome of what healthcare should be.
Yeah,
wow.
Sure.
How come I'm not hearing anybody talk about that anymore?
Sure. You know, let's have a Michael Moore sicko watching party. Seems like an opportune time, right? Oh, by the way, when it comes to the interesting perspective this administration, like the previous two terms of the Joe Biden administration, have with respect to our friends versus our enemies, our friends of freedom, like the Cuban people protesting or the Hong Kongans protesting,
right,
versus our enemies of freedom. The State Department informed Congress late last night it would waive sanctions on Iran's illicit oil trade so the country can access frozen funds from South Korea and Japan. This is the same day the Department of Justice announced charges on an Iranian spy network that sought to kidnap an American.
So we're rewarding them?
you know, just like the pallets of cash that were airdropped to the Iranians during Joe Obama's first two terms. So now we're continuing, you know, and obviously the glide path to nuclearization that was provided in Joe Obama's first two terms. Now we're giving them more access to cash, even as they continue to prove themselves to be a bad actor, you know, noting that they are the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism. Huh. But I don't want this to devolve into one of these partisan fights in this country, because this is just about freedom and dignity where it doesn't exist. And where doesn't it exist? What is the composition of those countries where people are oppressed? People are put in 21st century concentration camps. Is there any connection there, any link people see? Lewis on the South Side.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. The difference between those Venezuelans and all those other people is that the Cubans were flying the American flag, and they was talking about democracy. They weren't talking about socialism. They were trying to get away from socialism.
That's exactly right, Lewis. Yeah. I guess that was
They're more patriotic than some Americans are.
Certainly some American professional athletes and Olympians. Yeah. Yeah. I guess that's what roiled the left, is seeing foreign people flying the American flag.
Yeah, where are the where are the Spice Girls on this one?
You fly the American flag, then you can just forget about your asylum application. That's the posture of the left, it would seem. Interesting. From the same people that wanted to onboard all the Syrian refugees. Remember that crisis during Joe Obama's first two terms? The Syrian refugees were to be brought to this country without qualification. That was the posture they had. I mean, this is an open borders crowd, except for the Cuban people. Huh. I wonder if that has anything to do with the philosophy of those people in power in this country. This is just about freedom and dignity, but your perspective on how society should be ordered and the perspective of those in power on how society should be ordered has nothing to do with whether people have freedom and dignity or not. Really, it's fascinating. Fascinating, the dissociation that the left engages in to justify their pernicious, noxious, oppressive philosophy. How they have to run away from it when it inevitably ends badly. Venezuela, Cuba, China, everywhere it's tried.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, I thought this candidate was sort of interesting. This guy, Jake Beckett, he's running for Senate in Arkansas. He's a former Arkansas Razorback football player, but so is the guy he's running against. The incumbent is John Boozman, also a Republican. But, you know, Boozman's 70 years old, and he's been in Congress for 10 years. He's running for re-election for a second term to the United States Senate. But this 32-year-old former...
defensive lineman, it looks like.
Yeah, former lineman for the Razorbacks.
Awesome. Army vet.
He has this to say in terms of his value prop.
Well, it's tipped by Beckett. Knocked out by Jake Beckett.
Here comes Beckett. Down goes Shaw. The ball is out.
When you take the field between the lines here, there's no politics. There's no politically correct way to sack the quarterback. It's just cold, hard truth for everyone to see. Either your side wins or the other one does. I'm Jake Beckett. I'm no squish career politician. I'm a former All-SEC Razorback, a defensive end who sacked Tim Tebow, a Patriot who played with Tom Brady and won a Super Bowl, and an Army veteran who left the NFL and volunteered for the 101st Airborne in Iraq.
Jake Beckett, Patriot, Veteran, Razorback.
What's happening in Washington these days is a disgrace. Democrats have been taken over by radical socialists, and too many Republicans just go along to get along. Now more than ever, we have to stand up and fight for what we believe. I'm a God-fearing Christian conservative who is 100% pro-life and pro-police, and I will never apologize for being against illegal immigration. Like you, I'm sick and tired of the media lying, China getting away with murder, and politicians who only stand up for President Trump when they stand to benefit. The left is going to spend every dollar they can print to remake this country. Some will say that a young football-playing Army veteran isn't qualified to stop them. Or maybe they'll say, it's not my turn. But here's what I say. Just see if you can block me. I'm Jake Beckett. I'm a Razorback, a patriot, and a veteran. And I'm running for U.S. Senate because it's time to win our country back.
Why don't we have young, interesting candidates like that, like Jake Beckett in this state? We never have that.
No.
What was the last interesting young candidate?
Jason Plummer?
Yeah. He's in the state senate now.
Right. So he's moving up slowly.
Yeah.
I'll have to think about that. Coming up on Chicago's Morning Answer. I should ponder.
Still thinking about it. I mean, it was...
Well,
I was, you know, hoping you'd throw me a bone.
Dan Prof, when he ran for governor?
11 years ago, there was a young upstart. Now,
I did vote for you.
11 years, but I mean, so now it's...
I'm your one Lakeview vote.
It's all over. Yeah.
Well, Dan Prof was an up-and-comer.
Yeah, he was. But he got... It was, you know.
Well, you had a large field of candidates.
So that's why you know... Another one by the boards.
Yeah.
I hope Jake Beckett.
You didn't play football. You weren't a defensive.
I was. No, I wasn't. I hope it works out better for Jake Beckett. Is what I'm trying to say. I guess.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. Questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity this afternoon at 2 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I'm going to get to this example of a leftist getting mugged by the neo-Jacobins. But first, we were talking about this young former Arkansas football player running for Senate in Arkansas. Why don't we have any good young candidates in Illinois?
Yeah, he's an Army veteran, too. Left the NFL, played with Tom Brady, and went to serve and protect our country.
And he sacked Tim Tebow. That was on his resume. That was interesting. I sacked Tim Tebow. Oh, that's good enough. I guess in Arkansas, that probably is a vote getter. You were talking about this young candidate that you supported back in 2010, Amy.
You're trying to compare yourself to Jake?
No, I'm not comparing myself. We're talking about good young candidates.
Oh, okay.
And you were talking about me. You couldn't stop to... prattling on about me, what a great young candidate I was. You're just talking endlessly about it.
Oh, endlessly, yeah.
Yeah, talking about how you voted for me. Mike on the north side doesn't think that happened. Mike, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, good morning.
Hello.
Amy, you are a lying, dog-faced, Lincoln Park Trixie. To vote for Dan Prof for governor, you had to take a Republican ballot. And you were still a Democrat.
I'll bet $500.
We'll go down to the Board of Elections. Pick a charity.
Oh, my
$500.
God.
$500.
I'll bet. Let's make it $5,000. You can have my used minivan. I swear to God, I would not lie about
it. No. Nobody wants that minivan, okay? No one wants that minivan. You did not take a Republican ballot. You were one of those Lincoln Park Trixies.
No,
you thought
I don't
it was
drive
cool
a Jetta.
To vote for Rahm. You thought it was cool to vote for Rahm and vote for Daley. And vote for Blago, and it was a hip thing.
You don't have to take a Republican or a Democrat.
But if you look at my voting record, because didn't you pull my voting record for the primaries?
No.
Yeah, you did. I know you did one time because people called me and were like, that's so rude that he pulled your voting record. But I just looked it up.
Yeah,
I don't care. I have nothing to hide. I'm a former Democrat. It's a public document. Right, and that's why Warner Saunders never, ever voted in a primary.
All right, Mike, I'll book this bet. Amy seems pretty confident she pulled a Republican ballot in 2010.
I know I did. Look it up.
Are you sure you want to make this bet?
$500. Let's go right now.
$500.
All right.
Your primary, we'll check your primary ballot.
For 2010.
Because you might have voted Republican in the general election, but you did not. Too many prying eyes. Oh, she took a Republican ballot in a primary.
That's terrible. No, I did.
All right.
$500, Mike.
It's on. It's game
on. And I want it all in singles, buddy. Let's go.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Of course he's got it in singles. How else does he, you know, when he goes to his fashion shows for lunch.
He's a city worker.
Yeah.
Hard at work.
All right. $500.
Well, can
Amy
you pull
and Mike
that right
on the
now?
North side.
I know that you pulled it. I pulled a Republican ballot in 2010.
I'll look it up.
No, promise me, because $500 is a big deal.
I understand.
I could help a lot of children in the neighborhood, if you know what I mean.
Especially since you got kicked off the welfare rolls at CPS.
My link card, it expired. I only had $27 per kid on this. Yeah. So the glory days are over. But you should
for those
you would
not
be,
watching, she literally is holding up a link card.
Yeah, it's a PEBT card for the pandemic for each child. But I'm telling you, every kid in Chicago is carrying this around. They go and get themselves lunch or some snacks all the time with those.
The waving that link card around doesn't make you look as good as you think it does.
I'm just saying I'm real. And I was sucking off the teeth of the government for a while.
Yeah.
But you all benefited because I got to go to Whole Foods with this bad boy and get you some prime ribeye, not choice.
Yeah.
And I got you some Wagyu, I think. Maybe I ate it before I got here.
Sure. I mean, when it's on somebody else's dime, and Wagyu for everybody. Absolutely.
But you know, you've had some filet mignon. And some nice chicken dishes, courtesy of my son.
Okay, we need to get on to something substantive here. This is from Barry Weiss over at her Substack, former New York Times reporter, who was purged. But nothing like Maud Maron. Maud Maron was a public defender in New York City. Weiss writes, if you Google bleeding heart liberal, Maud Maron might well turn up as the first hit. She lived her early years in subsidized housing when her father walked on her mother. She was a pediatric nurse at Lenox Hill Hospital. Her mom remarried. They moved to Pennsylvania. She returned to New York City for college while a student at Barnard. Ooh. Marone was a clinic escort for Planned Parenthood. Of course she was. You already said she went to Barnard. Later, she went to Cardozo Law School, knowing she wanted to be a public defender. She was a student of Kathleen Cleaver, the former Black Panther, who was then a visiting professor. Of course, she was a visiting professor at Cardozo. She joined the Legal Aid Society in 1998, where she represented the most disadvantaged people in Manhattan. Maron and her husband, an Argentine immigrant, chose to send all their kids to public schools. In 2017 and again in 2019, she was elected to the local community education council, which is the equivalent of a school board. Then she decided to run as a Democrat for city council in Lower Manhattan. Mm-hmm. In short, Maron is exactly the kind of lawyer you'd imagine Legal Aid would put on the cover of its brochures. But now she's filing an employment discrimination suit in the Southern District of New York, against the Legal Aid Society she works for. The suit claims Maron was discriminated against on the basis of race. And it also claims that both the Legal Aid Society she worked for and her union published knowingly false statements in furtherance of ideological and political motives divorced from the core functions of her employment. In other words, she was forced out of her job because of her political views and her race, which is still a violation of the law. Even if you're white, you may be shocked to learn violation of Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. What's her view on this? None of this would have happened if I would have just said I loved books like White Fragility and I'm a fan of Bill de Blasio's proposals for changing New York City public schools and I plan to vote for Maya Wiley for mayor. The reason they went after me is I have a different point of view. The just a continuation on this story. And by the way, you know, we talked about this yesterday, the truths, the obvious truths that you can't say in social settings or you won't say in social settings, certainly in professional settings. But think about where this is going as you hear a little bit more about the Maud Maron story. You know, people say, well, can file suit. There's the Civil Rights Act that protects people in their employment based on their, you know, if they're going to be discriminated against based on race or, well, based on race in particular, the political views is a little bit more dicey. But is that a real remedy? Does that stop the purge litigation? Does this stop the purge?
Oh, we're always going to be under attack, I think. I wish not, but...
Think about that question. Why wouldn't this stop the purge? Why wouldn't this disincentivize the kind of barbarism you're seeing from those who cannot tolerate dissent? Or people of a different race? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. A former colleague of Marin said it was McCarthyism. That is the only word to describe it. Barry Weiss, the author of the piece, spoke to several others who said similar. The trouble began in late 2019 when Marin's boss informed her she was being investigated following a complaint from members of the Black Attorneys of Legal Aid Caucus and Attorneys of Color of Legal Aid. Marin says, I knew the accusations were baseless. It had everything to do with them deeming me an enemy of their politics and trying to go after me at work. After the investigation, which entailed reviewing all her case files, interviewing her direct supervisors, she was cleared in January of 2020, but she made a big mistake. The big mistake she made was after being cleared, she wrote an op-ed for the New York Post in which she said of this anti-bias training, those who oppose the like anti-racist, like Ibram Kendi, White Fragility, Robin DiAngelo, talk about all the time. Those who oppose this ideology are shunned and humiliated, even as it does nothing to actually improve our broken schools. Facing severe budget cuts, the DOE, Department of Education, has spent more than $6 million for the training, which defines qualities such as worship of the written word, individualism, and objectivity as white supremacy culture. So she wrote an op-ed in the New York Post after being cleared that was critical of the race hustle. And Barry Weiss writes, that's when things at work blew up. 3 days after she published the piece, the Black Attorneys of Legal Aid Caucus put out a lengthy statement saying that Maud Marin has no business having a career in public defense and we're ashamed that she works for the Legal Aid Society. Maud is racist and openly so, they said, offering no evidence. Who needs evidence? This she was a prominent opponent of equality, according to the Black Attorneys of Legal Aid Caucus, and a classic example of what 21st century racism looks like. It's not funny, but it's remarkable when you see the snake eat the tail, don't you? Isn't it, I should say. And don't we see that here? One former colleague telling Barry Weiss, you know, the power this has. Calling somebody racism in an organization like Legal Aid, quote, is the equivalent of calling someone who works at a Jewish organization anti-Jewish. It becomes impossible to work there. Her former supervisor, a guy named James Chubinsky, who was at Legal Aid for 41 years, said of Maud Marin, she was beyond terrific. When she joined the Bronx Division, I didn't understand why she wasn't coming as a supervisor given her resume. She handled the toughest cases and assignments, did an enormous amount of work. She went out of her way to engage the less experienced lawyers in the cases that she was handling. Any suggestion that she was anything other than a top-flight lawyer that the Legal Aid Society should be damn proud to have on their staff is a crock. And other former colleagues say the same. And so she's filed suit. Because she wasn't allowed to be white and have the opinions that she had. Really, I don't think the color matters so much. It just was very convenient. It's much easier to slap the racist tag on her because she is white. But it was her views, obviously. A woman of the left bounced out of Legal Aid Society. Because she's not down with the race hustle. And so I go back again to the question. So this is a one-off story. These things happen. It's terrible, but you have a court system, and she can litigate the issue as she is, and hopefully that will have a chilling effect. Why won't it have a chilling effect? It won't. It will not have a chilling effect, no matter how many lawsuits are filed. Why do you think that is? Why do you think we can't stop the witch trials? Like this. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Any thoughts?
I just feel like that's our new normal.
Well, yeah. I know. That's what's happening. That is what's happening. This is becoming
normal.
And
that's her way to fight back is through the lawsuit, through litigation. Is it going to stop it? No. But she might feel some justice from it.
Well, I know in her case, this is the one thing, this is something that she individually can do. But why is this, as the answer, insufficient? It's a tactic, but it can't be the strategy. Why? Mike in Plano, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, you know, I've noticed this too in the sports world with, Scottie Pippen accusing Phil Jackson of racism. You got the Maria Taylor and Rachel Nichols controversy between a black woman and a white woman fighting over who gets to cover the NBA Finals. You had Stephen A. Smith having to apologize because he mentioned how Shohei Ohtani, the baseball player, doesn't speak English, and that would make it hard for him to be a star here. And that's, quote-unquote, insensitive against Asians. But all these people I mentioned are members of the left, and they're eating their own. And it's kind of fun to watch after all these years of accusing people like us who are sports fans of racism. And I was listening to Jason Whitlock the other day. He's talking about the Taylor and Nichols. She was like, oh, I wish I could sit down and talk with them. And I was like, no, let them fight it out. You know, these are liberal women. They claim to be strong-minded, strong-willed, and independent. They don't need men for anything. Let them dig their own graves.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Well, there's two things. You're right. I mean, I don't, when, you know, your enemies are destroying each other, don't interrupt. I understand that. But this is also an opportunity to perhaps enlist some coalition partners in advance of a free society, at least on some issues. Not, it's not going to be all, but on some issues, somebody like Maude Marin, who just got mugged by the reality of the her fellow travelers and who they really are, generally speaking, her fellow travelers. Yeah, so I get that. But, of course, they're not just going to eat their own. They're going to eat everything that they can. I mean, their appetite is rapacious. Their appetite for punishment and elimination of dissent is rapacious. So it's, you know, just because they're going after Maude Marin doesn't mean they're going to stop, obviously, going after conservatives or center-right people or independents or anybody who doesn't fall in line when it comes to, for example, here, the anti-racist hustle. So why is that not enough? Watching your enemies destroy one another. Mostly the Jacobins destroying leftists who, again, don't hew the line. And litigation. Why is that not enough? Candace in Mount Pleasant.
Everything is about optics, and in our shallow world that we live in, and the left knows that, and nobody has had the proper optics back. We need a Norma Rae movement within teachers. But they're too worried about their pensions and their money. We need moms to fight back, but too many of them are worried about keeping their big house in Hinsdale rather than worried about their children. So that's what we need, but we're not going to get that movement because we've just, I don't know, it seems like parents have turned into gutless cowards, and we already know the left are cowards.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Candace.
So true.
Joe in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I think to answer your question, Dan, it's a little bit complicated, but in essence, the left has given up the virtues of Judeo-Christian ethics and culture, and now are replete with this self-designed sort of religion, humanist religion, that's devoid of charity and forgiveness. And it's replaced it with a form of self-righteousness. You know, you always quote the famous statement about courage being the formation of all other virtues.
Yes, Lewis.
That's part of it. And it's also what Cicero said, that gratitude is not only the greatest of the virtues, it's the father of all others.
Mm-hmm.
And both those things are missing, the courage on the right and the gratitude and charity on the left.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Joe. I think you're definitely getting to it. You know, legal aid society, these certainly public sector institutions, Fortune 1000 companies. Oh, they have money. They have money. They have money to litigate or to settle. The important thing is that they get rid of you. They get rid of Maude Marin. She's out. That's the important thing. And if that costs a few bucks, it's well worth it to close ranks, to eliminate dissent, to marginalize dissenters, ostracize them from civil society and access to anything resembling power, like, for example, in the criminal justice system as a public defender. That's why litigation is insufficient.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, Rebecca Solnit writing in The Guardian. Every week I temper the terrible news from catastrophes such as wildfires, from scientists measuring the chaos by trying to put them in context of positive technological milestones and legislative shifts and their consequences. You could call each of them a turning point. The point last week at which Oregon passed the bill setting the most aggressive clean electricity standards in the U.S., 100% clean by 2040. The point at which Scotland began getting more electricity from renewables than it could use. The point at which New York State banned fracking. Turning points is what she's looking for. Because, citing contents from a forthcoming Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. Quote, climate change will fundamentally reshape life on Earth in the coming decades. Even if humans can tame planet warming greenhouse gas emissions, species extinction, more widespread disease, unlivable heat, ecosystem collapse, cities menaced by rising seas. These and other devastating climate impacts are accelerating and bound to become painfully obvious before a child born today turns 30. The choices societies make now will determine whether our species thrives or simply survives as the 21st century unfolds. Well, that's sort of tamped down hysteria. Normally, we're not going to survive when it comes to these Nostradamus is there and world government that make all of these dire predictions about what the world is going to look like. I remember when they said the same thing would happen by, 2001. Now it's 2051.
We have some more time. That's good.
Yeah, we got a little bit more time.
Yeah. I like that.
It's good because, you know, that means like Greta Thunberg has a lifetime's worth of fear-mongering that she can do for profit. For more on the topic of climate change, because, of course, this is going to be, from a policy perspective, I mean, you've got the backdrop of the infrastructure/Green New Deal that's pending. You also have the Biden administration wanting to do other things like build transmission lines to transport renewable electricity across states, which they say will improve grid reliability. Well, what's happening in California as an example of this is not a model that should be scaled, it actually turns out. So for more on this discussion, we're pleased to be joined by David Simon. He's a fellow at the Washington-based Committee to Unleash Prosperity and a lawyer here in Chicago. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Good morning. So you heard the call for a turning point in the minds of Moore, and against the backdrop of these customary dire predictions from the UN's IPCC about what the world is going to look like in the next 30 years if we don't take the evasive action to, you know, run our economies on switchgrass and Vermont maple syrup.
I did. And I'd say that the doomsday claims are religious in nature. They're not based on scientific facts. Scientific facts show that things are fine in terms of where the climate is now. It's not an imminent threat of any kind. In fact, life on Earth is getting better. People are living longer as the temperature warms slightly. Improved growing seasons for crops. I think we're going to be all right. I wouldn't sell everything. Let's put it that way.
Well, what is this whole theory about, you know, the environmental impact of having children on the environment? Because yesterday or 2 days ago, and Dan tweeted this out too, Meghan Markle and Prince Harry are receiving an environmental award for deciding to have only two children. And they're doing it because they want to preserve the environmental impact of only having two children.
Absolute insanity. The single greatest thing that people create solutions to problems. The more people we have, the more solutions to problems we come up with. So as problems come up, we are more likely to come up with a solution if we have more available minds out there. So when you have more children, you have more people. More people mean more brains to solve problems. There's no reason not to have children.
But like, who started that having a smaller family impacts or reduces our impact on the Earth?
Oh, my gosh. This has been going on at least since Paul Ehrlich's population bomb in 1968 that turned out to be a dud. Right, David?
Exactly. Couldn't have said it better myself. And I would add that one of the people who was very supportive of Paul Ehrlich, a man named John Holdren, also has been very, very involved in this climate scare. He was President Obama's science advisor, I believe.
I just love they are the it couple, that prince and princess, or the, you know, former prince and princess, whatever their status is. They really the it couple for sentimental barbarism in the Western world now. I mean, they're just such disgusting people. They have the same philosophy practically as Chinese communists who now, by the way, are on a three-child policy. They upped it again. But Meghan and Harry are on the two-child policy. I mean, you talk about connecting this to the ideology of the central planner of the autocrat, because that's really what this population control movement is about.
That's exactly right. It is an attempt based on either some truly felt or completely invented view that that there's something wrong with the planet, and that there's more importantly something wrong with human beings, how we interact with the planet. But that is being used as an excuse to completely and draconianly reorganize our economy in ways that will be very harmful for us, that will give great power to the federal government.
But part of this, just because it's, you know, hurricane season in the Southeast, and talking about wildfires, and you're in the context of climate change, we know we're going to hear this argument. You make a point in a recent piece that NOAA, and this has been the case for a long time, that there is no link between climate change, between global warming specifically, which is what we used to call it, or they used to call it. There's no link between that and natural disasters.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. I mean, some years we have more, some years we have less, but over the long term, when we look at it, we look at the data, the number of hurricanes isn't greater, et cetera. And more importantly, the way we adapt to these things means that if there were an increase, it would not be a problem. Over the last 100 years, 80% less people around the globe, over 80% less people around the globe die from natural disasters, even though there are four times as many of us. So even if there were to be more hurricanes or more tornadoes or more forest fires, of those kinds of things, human beings would adapt and find ways to even better protect ourselves than we do now.
What about, you know, the heat waves that are going on in the West? I mean, St. George hit 117, which is the highest temperatures they've ever seen there.
We have hot weather. We have cold weather. It goes up and down. The earth gets warmer and colder over very long periods of time. Human beings have a very small role in this, but there's something called the medieval warming period. Hundreds of years ago, the earth was significantly warmer than it is now. Then it cooled down a bit. Lately, it's over the last 100 years, it's warmed up about 1.3 degrees centigrade. But the amounts that human beings affect this are very small, and the variations in weather happen over time. I mean, in the 1930s with the Dust Bowls, we had extremely hot temperatures in much of the United States. And while parts of the world and the country, you may have particularly hot weather, sometimes we have particularly cold weather in other parts of it at times. Cooler summers in some places, warmer summers in other places. It comes and goes, but the numbers are not particularly unusual or extraordinary.
No causal link there, but there is a link between energy consumption and economic vitality. The United States, the world's largest economy, is also the world's largest energy consumer. You know, when you stop consuming energy, like energy consumption fell by 5% last year, you stop enjoying economic vitality and all the associated benefits in terms of quality of life.
That's exactly right. The United States economy has become more and more efficient over the last few decades, so we use less and less energy to achieve the same purpose. But when a country isn't using energy, it means that it's dying. If you look at maps at night, pictures at night of places in the world, the rich places are all lit up because people have electricity. Buildings are lit up, and places that don't are dark. You look at the famous global photo of North Korea and South Korea at night. South Korea is all lit up. North Korea is just maybe a couple dots of light, but it's completely dark because it's so poor. People are starving. They can't afford electricity for their homes, and office buildings even stay dark much of the time because they just don't have the power. They don't have the ability to do that. To the extent they do, it's way too expensive for them because they're so messed up.
Yeah, it's interesting too, the reaction to those pushing the hysteria around climate change. Because, number one, they're generating pushback from within that community. I mean, the most notably, Michael Schellenberger, who wrote this incredible apology for his participation as an environmental activist in some of the climate change hysteria over the last 30 years. He's been an environmental activist, and he's written a lot about this for Forbes. His book last year, we talked to him about it. And also former top scientist at EPA for the Obama administration, Steve Koonin, who also wrote a book called Unsettled, and we talked to him about that as well. And they're having a hard time persuading even their constituents, people that are, generally less paying less attention than obviously an environmental activist or a scientist like Koonin. And I know that because the EU is now proposing climate tariffs, or is about to propose climate tariffs, because, they can't persuade their constituents to do what they say is in their self-interest. It really annoys the central planners when people don't have the same Chicken Little philosophy that they do. And so they're coming at it from a lot of different angles. And all of these indications are they're having a very hard time generating the hysteria they seek to generate about climate change. I guess this is why they need to extend COVID.
You got it exactly right. Mr. Koonin's book, by the way, is world class. The book Unsettled, one of the big points it makes is that the models that are being used to predict this climate apocalypse are extremely unreliable. They can't even reproduce the temperatures we've had over the last 100 years. I mean, it's like saying we're going to stake our fate on a test for a new disease, yet when you test people, say you test 1,000 people actually have the disease, the test comes back negative for many of them. And when you test 1,000 people who don't have the disease, the test comes back positive for a lot of them. The results are completely unreliable, even for people with the results really are. Why would you believe that? Why would you believe the test is any good at predicting the future?
And what they do is they say, we're going to make the cost of things more expensive through tariffs, taxes. We're going to punish you through reduced energy access, so you have rolling blackouts like you do in California. So until you sign on to what we want to do, we're going to punish you. So it's not persuasion, it's coercion, government coercion in advance of, you know, whatever they say, the models say.
Completely true. And at the same time, and when it comes to things like the tariffs you're talking about, they'll also, by the way, happen to benefit favored local industries.
He is David Simon. He's a fellow at the Washington-based Committee to Unleash Prosperity and a lawyer in Chicago. David, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Chicago. Did you tweet it out yet?
No, I will, though. Again, the top line here. First time in Chicago, 911 calls for mental health emergency won't be answered by police, but by mental health professionals paired with paramedics. In one pilot program starting the fall, a paramedic will be dispatched with a mental health clinician for behavioral health calls. In another, a paramedic will work with a recovery specialist on calls involving substance abuse. And then, so then when somebody pulls a weapon on them, is that when they call 911 wanting to have the cops show up? Or do they call, when they are overwhelmed, do they call more mental health clinicians and paramedics for backup? Or do they then get the police involved?
This is not going to end well.
Not for those responding to 911 calls. Glad I'm not one of them.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Some quick back-of-the-envelope math. Amy, you were noting the Chicago public school system, underfunded, always perpetually underfunded. Just unveiled a $9.3 billion budget.
Billion, not million, $9.3 billion budget.
What do we say, about 325,000 kids? Is that
335,
fair?
I bet, after everybody left for private schools.
So some back-of-the-envelope math, that's just under, it's about $28,000 per student.
For what? What are we getting?
Underfunded. Interesting. Infrastructure underfunded, too. Which is why, and so are poverty programs, which is why Senate Democrat Socialists agreed to a $3.5 trillion health care and anti-poverty plan. That's the way it's being described. Now, again, this is restrained because it's well short of the $6 trillion deal that socialists like Bernie Sanders wanted. He endorsed the deal. Yeah, I'd like $6 trillion. But I'll take $3.5 trillion, which is, you know, wonderful sausage making, you know, important compromises, sensible, so that we can move the country forward into fiscal oblivion. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author. Steve, good news on that anti-poverty plan, huh?
Good morning, guys. Well, the big two stories are related on the economy from yesterday. So first, we get the story about the massive number on inflation, 5.4%. So prices are rising in the economy. It is unquestionable now. And 5.4, by the way, if you look at from the start of the year, we're on a pace of inflation of over 8%. So these are very, very frighteningly bad numbers. And then you add to that Bernie Sanders, a few hours later, says, hey, we're going to spend $3.5 trillion more. Of course, it's not going to be paid for. It's going to be just dumping $100 bills out of helicopter windows. This is going to make inflation much, much worse. The dumbest thing we could do right now is spend and borrow $3.5 trillion, and it looks like that's exactly what the Democrats want to do.
And what about gas prices? I mean, what is that going to top off at, $5 a gallon? Rate we're going?
You know, it's a good question. If you look at the the forecasts right now. Harold Hamm, who's the guy who kind of invented the whole shale oil and gas revolution, he was telling me that he thinks that the oil price is going to go up to as high as $100 a barrel. And that is the equivalent of about $4 a gallon. By the way, if you live in California, you're already paying, $5 a gallon gasoline in California.
Oh, my gosh.
Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
$5.
Yeah, well, everybody's got to pony up a little bit to save the planet. And it's just like we have to pony up a little bit to pull everybody out of poverty. You know, it was an interesting stat. I was talking about this yesterday with one of our local guys, Steve. This Boston Fed paper that finds when you include unrealized benefits like Social Security, 401k, when you net present value them, one in four Americans in their 40s is a millionaire. One in four Americans. So, you know, this is still an economy and a country where people work hard and they do well and they climb the socioeconomic ladder. That still happens. And I feel like as free market types, we don't talk enough about the success stories in America and the success story that is America.
You know, well put. Very well put. So, August 12th is the 40-year anniversary of, do you know what happened 40 years ago on August 12th?
I don't, but Dan's thinking about it.
August 12th, 1981. It was the Reagan tax cut.
Oh, Reagan tax cut.
Reagan
sure.
tax cut.
Yeah.
Which changed. Now, here's the amazing thing. Here's your kind of financial question for the day. Do you know what the Dow Jones Industrial Average was in the summer of 1981?
I was just a toddler then. I wasn't invested in the market.
Oh, you
at the
were
time.
So.
Yeah, I was. I wasn't.
I know, but
yeah.
Amy's much older than you.
Well, exactly.
Hey.
Right. Exactly.
Easy there, Steve.
She would probably know the answer. Yeah.
I'm teasing, of course.
I don't remember.
Okay. 1,000. The Dow Jones was 1,000 in 1981. Today, the Dow Jones is at 35,000. So we have lived through the greatest period of wealth creation in the history of civilization. Our stock market and all the value of our financial assets are closing in on $100 trillion. We are five times more wealth than China does. Japan and Europe have been basically flatlined during that period. So America is the alpha male. We're just crushing everybody. And even when we do stupid things, the economy still does pretty well. I am worried about Biden's agenda. I think it is frighteningly stupid. The lesson we should have learned from Reagan and Trump, frankly, is, you know, you cut tax rates, you bring capital, you bring investment to the U.S. of A. Now we got a Treasury Secretary, Dan Meany. I never thought I'd see the day. We've got a Treasury Secretary, United States Treasury Secretary, running around the world, urging all the other countries in the world to raise their taxes. It's maddening. We're going to have a global minimum tax, folks. Everybody's going to pay high taxes. There's not, you know, they talk about monopolies. How about this monopoly of government, Dan? We've got all these governments colluding to raise taxes on everybody, so it doesn't matter where you, maybe you can try to go to Bermuda or Ireland. Ireland has the lowest tax rate, 12.5%, but they're strong arming Ireland to raise their taxes. I mean, it's these politicians are a monopolist, and they're trying to – by the way, tax competition is a good thing, Janet Yellen. It's not a race to the bottom. It's a race to the top.
And the other,
more freedom and less government.
I guess we all got to move to Ireland. And then the connection to that, the other collusive behavior, raise taxes and also spending and just call everything infrastructure, which we see, obviously, the Biden administration doing. And just address what we know to be true. You know, the economics we know to be true about infrastructure spending being pro-growth. Everything they say, everything has a positive return. Every dollar government spends has a positive return to hear the politicians talk about it. But, you know, while there may need to be upgrades made to some roads and bridges, it is not a growth policy. It does nothing for GDP.
Nothing. I mean, because every time the government spends a dollar, it has to take a dollar from you and me to spend it. I mean, this stuff isn't complicated. Now, if you actually think the government gets a higher rate of return than, say, a private business. I mean, it's just proven untrue. By the way, of that $1.2 trillion spending bill they passed, the infrastructure bill, only about one-fifth of that money is even roads and bridges. Most of it's for green energy stuff. And here's my favorite one. They want to have the federal government spend tens of billions of dollars building electric charging stations around the country
yeah.
for people who have their Tesla.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, do you recall the United States government building gasoline stations around the country?
Right.
Right. No. There's this big push in Illinois with a campaign. No, they're having billboards showing people, you know, who do drive electric cars where to pull off the road to get, you know, to get a to plug in, so to speak.
Where do they think they're going to get the? Where do I mean? People are so stupid. Where do you think they get the electricity from to charge your battery? You know what? Have you seen what's happened to coal price? It's doubled. The demand for coal is surging around the world. The good news is America has more coal than any other country. The bad news is Biden won't let us mine for our coal, so they're using dirtier coal in China. And China's building 15 coal plants right now, as we speak. China's building 15 new coal plants. Do you think that they care about global warming?
Not particularly. About as much as they care about human rights. Yeah. I got a question for you. You know, you talk to all of these politicians, so we don't have to. So on both the tax side and the spending side, what do you think the Biden administration gets? Do they get some approximation of what they want on tax increases, corporate rate to 21%, and this this infrastructure deal? Or what do you think is going to happen?
It's hard. That's a hard question. Look, they're not going to get a 43% capital gains tax. They're not going to get a 28% corporate rate, but they are. I think they will get a small tax increase through. It'll be negative, it'll reduce American competitiveness. The rest of the world will laugh behind our backs. And by the way, the global tax, that'll last about 6 months, and then all the other countries are going to start cheating. And of course, you know, they're going to start lowering their taxes, and yeah. we're going to be the people out there. So I think they might get a smaller. The reason I think the market's held up so well over the last 6 months is I think investors have figured out, no, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden are not going to get this through. But you know what? You're going to have Joe Manchin on your show, and you're going to ask him, because he's the second most important, you know, guy in Washington right now. Because if he agrees to kill the filibuster and all these other things, we're sunk. So, you know, the fate of the nation depends on Joe Manchin. Can you get him on your show and ask him that question?
We'll try.
We'll effort that. Yeah, we got some friends in West Virginia. We'll see if we can squeeze him to come on the show.
I mean, I'm not joking, folks. He's the second.
No, he's the one.
If he caves on this stuff, we are going to get him. You know, he says one thing one day. He's loving life, by the way. I mean, everywhere he goes, all the cameras follow him all around. But, you know, I hate this because Joe Manchin's a politician. And with it, you know, the whole economy depends on whether he's going to agree to this Biden $3.5 trillion spending thing. Right now, it does look like Bernie Sanders is calling the shots right now. And that's pretty frightening.
I know this is not as exciting as taxing and spending, but the regulatory agencies play a big role in whether we grow or not, too. And Biden's new EO, recent EO, telling the FTC and FCC, to Federal Trade Commission, Federal Communication Commission, and all other agencies to stop acquisitions, no non-competes, minimize licenses, all of this anti-competitiveness that's been presented as making capitalism more competitive.
So I was telling Larry Kudlow on his show last night that, you know, I've come up with a new Biden definition of a monopoly. You know what a monopoly is? It's a company that dares make a profit.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, folks. These people are freaking crazy. They see a monopoly on every street corner. They want to regulate and restrict, I mean, every activity of every single business in America. And it's the exact opposite of what we did. You know, let's go back to the start of this conversation. When the Dow was at 1,000, what did we do? We massively cut taxes, and we massively cut regulation, and the economy boomed. Biden comes in, he wants to do the exact opposite. So I did read that executive order. It's about 14 pages long. It's written by these dingbat left-wing economic professors who have now populated the White House, who know nothing about business. That's the other thing. None of these law professors have ever run anything in their whole life. Let's see them create a monopoly. It ain't so easy. So let's see them make a profit in anything that they do. I mean, but these guys are second-rate left-wing, you know, they're philosophy, sociology professors, and they're telling businesses how to run their business. It's crazy.
How about United States Senators Brian Schatz, who's a senator from Hawaii, and I thought Macy Hirano was the dumb one. He tweeted out, "I'm not a slogan guy, but I see no reason we shouldn't call the cash assistance to families Biden bucks."
Well, what did we have? Remember, what was Obama? We had the Obama
Phones. Obama phones. Biden bucks. I mean,
Biden bucks. That's
You talk about monopolies. That's monopoly money, is what it is. Steve Moore.
Oh, by the way, I know we're running out of time, but now there's a bill in Congress to have another round of payments.
Of course.
Another round.
Free money.
Yeah, of course. Let's let people play video games for another few more months. Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author. Thanks, Steve.
See you guys.
Hopefully it'll end in September. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Today's the day. I just heard our HR director, Debbie Litwin, walk by and say, "Happy picnic day." And you're not wearing shorts or the Hawaiian shirt for our picnic. Our welcoming everybody back.
Yeah, no, I attended the meeting.
Oh, and remember, next Friday is Hawaiian shirt day. So, you know, if you want to, go ahead and wear a Hawaiian shirt and jeans.
Yeah, I'm going to wear that Friday.
No, we're having a picnic today, and we look forward to seeing everyone. This is the invitation.
Everyone, like all our listeners are invited too?
No. Just so the staff. We're welcoming the staff back, but this is from Jeff Reisman saying, "We look forward to seeing you at our company barbecue/picnic. Please bring your appetite!" Exclamation point. We're going to have cheddar burgers and cheddar fries. Assuming your schedule allows, dress very casual for the day. Shorts and gym shoes are fine. For picnic day.
Are you done, like, doing your dutiful polishing of Jeff Reisman's apple now?
We have 9 participants for the Cornhole Bags Tournament. I get one more competitive volunteer to even up the teams?
I would dominate that. But
you're not on the list. I'm not going to the picnic. Quinn McCarthy, Jeff Reisman, Jim Minardi.
Yeah. Why aren't a lot you of great athletes on that list.
Yeah. D1. We're talking D1 talent.
Yeah. I can't. First of all, I don't go to picnics because I'm antisocial. Number one. Number two, I'm going to play golf at Harbor Shores. I'm driving up to Benton Harbor to play Harbor Shores.
You go right after the show?
Yeah.
Or are you going to leave early?
No. I'm going to stick it out.
You're going to stick it out?
Yeah. I'm going to stick it out for one more hour.
That'll take, 3 hours to get up there?
No.
With the time change?
Maybe in that jalopy that you drive. No. It's like an hour and a half from the city.
Well, you should be a family, like a company guy. Not a family man, a company man.
Oh, right.
Or the picnic.
Yeah, exactly. So I can brown nose. I'm not going to outcompete you on that score. That's the one thing. We're a family here at this place of employment. I'm not a subscriber to that theory.
Okay.
I'm not. I mean, I know you're.
You're
our mom.
Yeah, I'm the show's mom.
Mom.
I'm the show's mom.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's not a bad thing.
No, it's wonderful.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Maybe there is a psychological reason why there are so many fear-addled COVIDians. It's perhaps the difference in risk aversion between men and women. Maybe this is a contributing factor. Not obviously the whole story. A new study out of Moscow, the Russians, finds that the brain scans show differences between men and women when it comes to their response to a risk aversion exercise. Each participant in the study had their brain's magnetic fields analyzed using a magnetoencephalography scan. And I just am doing this story because I wanted to say magnetoencephalography scan.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Which magnetoencephalography.
Common spelling.
That was the name of my high school band.
A cover band for?
Thomas Dolby. Oh. We killed with She Blinded Me with Science. And so here's the test. The test had a group select several mystery boxes out of a pile of 100 boxes, each with containing a cash prize. Oh, it's like a game show. We love this when it comes to COVID-related vaccine lotteries. 100 boxes, each containing a cash prize. However, one of the boxes also contained a quote-unquote bomb that would wipe out all of the contestants' winnings. And it turns out men had a bigger appetite for risk. On average, men selected 48 boxes in comparison to just 40 boxes for women. So what are we to do about these risk-averse women? The anxiety they have with risk, Amy.
They're protecting the children.
Yeah, I know. It's all
instead
for the kids.
Of watching the news, they should read some articles. Because I was a COVIDian. I mean, you remember me.
Yeah, I know. You were a complete crackpot.
I was out of my mind.
Yeah.
And I washed my hands so much that they were bleeding. And I cried when I got Clorox wipes for Christmas from a friend.
Best like, Christmas
that was
ever.
That was really giving.
Well,
I mean, things that people did. My friend, she was forced to pee and poop in a bucket in her parents' garage because they wouldn't let her in the house to use the bathroom for fear of germs. No, that's it. I'm saying that is probably the craziest story that I've heard.
All right, well, let's find out what else is wrong with women's brains.
Okay.
To help us do that, we're pleased to be... Now, I'm this is a close call. What? You know, I only call medical doctors doctors.
Right.
So Jill Biden is not a doctor. Well, PhD is not a doctor. I have a Juris Doctorate. I'm not a doctor.
Oh, so you are one.
No, I'm not. So licensed mental health counselor with a doctorate in counseling psychology.
I'm going to go with doctor.
All right, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Dr. Gregory Jans joins us. He's the founder of The Center, A Place of Hope. The Center, A Place of Hope is the place. He's also the author of The Anxiety Reset, a life-changing approach to overcoming fear, stress, worry, panic attacks, OCD, and more. Dr. Gregory Jans, how does it make you feel when I call you doctor?
Oh, good morning. You can call me whatever you need to. That point doesn't matter to me. Okay. I've been doing that. This is my 38th year. And we're seeing anxiety is at the all-time highs.
Well, how do you help patients and people that are just not ready to go back to the way life used to be?
Oh, my goodness. And are we ever seeing that? So we work with folks from all over the country. And one of the patterns that we're seeing right now, and it's that old tip of the iceberg, 2 years of a pandemic and what that did to our mental health. Now we're beginning to see addiction rates are at all-time highs. We've never seen addiction where it is now. Depression rates are all-time high. Anxiety disorders. So this has paralyzed people, and really in some regards, I use the word stronghold. It's got a stronghold on their lives, and it's still dictating their well-being.
So how do you?
That's what we're seeing.
Yeah, so how do you approach people that have irrational fears? I mean... there's a threat that exists, but their response is just disproportional to the threat, whether it's a virus or something else. What's the approach?
Well, one of the things, we have two choices. We can either be critical of them or show compassion. And today, when I see people, and I had a situation yesterday where I still saw a great deal of fear from somebody, and totally masked up the gloves, the whole bit. And it was fear. And so we have what's called irrational fears that have developed. They're not really based in reality, but it's created almost this obsessive compulsive disorder for folks that go, because they don't know, they're not sure. And so they're afraid. And we've been told so many things over the last 2 years. And what's true? I don't know what's true, so I have to do this. And so people are still living. They're still living in some unknowns. They're still living in fear. They're still hearing contradictory information on vaccinations. They don't know what to believe or who to believe. Anytime you have that, you're going to have anxiety.
And so that should be received, or the response to that should be to ridicule them, to shame them and tell them they're terrible people, right?
that's the whole thing.
That's my
criticism
approach.
Versus compassion.
Yeah.
And we've got to win the trust back, and we've got to tell people that, hey, look, no, we really care. And many times a person has had things happen in their life. There's been trauma. There's emotional abuse, but there's been some trauma. And this whole thing now that we've all walked through is just another tipping point for them. So it's pushed them over the edge. And we really are at a mental health epidemic. There is a crisis. We have got young people who have failed academically. We have the highest suicide rates in the 12 to 17 year old range. So we have a major mental health crisis, but that's not in the news. That's not in the forefront.
No.
But that's what people are facing.
I mean, I told Pritzker October 27th of 2020, there is not a psych bed within 60 miles of Chicago. People need help. There's 1,800 people on a waiting list at Lurie Children's Hospital to take care of mental health issues. That's what we need. But we also need to get back to normal, because that's killing us more than COVID is. But I wanted to ask you about parents. You know, what are they conditioning their kids? Like, so if you have somebody that's a COVIDian, how is that affecting their children?
Well, what we're doing, see, fear is generally something we've learned. And I love the study you mentioned, because we're either learning fear or we're learning appropriate risk-taking. So kids have learned, and I'm making some general statements, but they've learned to be afraid of the world. This is a fearful place. In fact, you know, we've got kids wearing masks, and there honestly is no reason to do that. That's only creating fear. And so we've conditioned them to be afraid. Well, fear always has a ripple effect. I get afraid in one area of my life, and then it begins to affect another area. So kids and normal socialization and things that need to be normal, that's been disrupted. And so we're going to see there's a price to pay for what we've done with kids.
And part of it is not, I think you suggest, is not just, overt fear mongering. Be very afraid of this. This is lethal. This could kill you, so on and so forth. But it's also when people in positions of authority offer contradictory advice or reverse themselves and then reverse themselves again on best practices, that creates more anxiety and thus more fear, because it's you're looking to the authority for the known, and what you're getting is the unknown.
Right. And then we don't know who to trust. And so if we keep changing the rules or telling us what's true and we don't know, it creates distrust. So we have a huge problem with distrust, with people and mental health issues. And I know that the need is great. And I really want to just say, I'm so sorry for what has happened, because if you've struggled, this really could be pushing you over the edge still. And people need to know that there's hope available and there's help available.
All right. So what do you need to do today to recover your emotional and mental health?
Well, one of the first things we need to do is people have stopped caring for themselves in some very basic areas. Exercise, getting movement. When you're afraid, change your environment. Get outside. Change the room. Change the environment. Always mix movement with drinking water. You need to be careful what you're putting in your mouth. What's happened is people have started drinking alcohol at 2 in the afternoon because they were working at home. And so what's going in your mouth that is super important. Like the guy I talked to, goes, I think I'm up to about 12 cups of coffee a day. Mm. Well, that's not going to help you with your anxiety.
No.
So, some of the basics. What about sleep? I used to work in sleep research. What we're finding, and the term that we're hearing more of, is sleep epidemic. Sleep disorders now are peaking at all-time high because people are waking up during the night really having an anxiety attack, and their heart's racing, and they're going, what's happening? And they can't get back to sleep. So sleep stages have been disrupted.
You know what's it helps with sleeping? Drinking. That's how you solve that problem.
No, you think it does. But
no, I'm kidding. For people that you've treated that came in and they're, you know, sort of afraid of their shadow, and then they right themselves and they get better. What do they say sort of in response? Like, what was the key to bringing them out of their psychosis?
Well, one of the yesterday, somebody said this to me. They said, I wish I wouldn't have waited so long. I waited till things got so bad I couldn't function. Mm. So that's what we're hearing. You don't have to wait until you're on the edge. You don't have to wait because anxiety distorts reality. Fear begins to change how we perceive the world. Fear begins to change how we see ourselves. It creates self-doubt. You go to indecision. You're probably not doing the things you want to be doing because you're afraid. So that's what fear does. Really, the word is, don't wait so long to get help. We can disrupt this cycle. Fear, living in fear, by the way, ultimately changes our body chemistry. So we need to look at, you know, our brain chemistry, for example. We know that a pattern of fear will alter our brain chemistry. We can see this in SPECT scans of the brain. So it will have an effect on you in your life. Mm. And you don't have to live with that fear.
Dr. Gregory Jance, licensed mental health counselor, founder of The Center, A Place for Hope, author of the book, The Anxiety Reset, A Life-Changing Approach to Overcoming Fear, Stress, Worry, Panic Attacks, OCD, and more. Dr. Jance, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, great to be with you today. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
It's time for Animal Stories with Uncle Dan and Little Amy.
Dan and Amy, this out of England. Boiling lobsters alive would be banned under legislation that was introduced to protect the welfare rights of crustaceans and mollusks, the latest victim group.
It is disturbing. Have you ever seen it? I heard it.
I do it for ate sport. It.
That lobster, when they squeal like that, it's awful.
This would
then you eat it though.
This would
good.
Animal welfare bill would defend against the inhumane treatment of creatures with backbones. Well, that certainly would eliminate most of the parliament, wouldn't it? As
Hey-o.
Well as our Congress. Thank you very much. To include invertebrates such as lobsters, crabs, octopuses, and squid. Yeah, you have a problem with that?
I think that's ridiculous. You're eating it anyway. But I don't eat octopus now after I watched My Octopus Teacher on Netflix. I will never have calamari again.
Why?
Because
of the wonderful relationship he had with the squid? I mean, it's ridiculous.
I cried in that movie. My Octopus Teacher, you should watch it. It's really sad. I'm not going to tell you how to end.
I've seen it. That's how I
Did
know
you
the
cry,
relationship.
Yeah. You didn't cry?
I don't cry. I don't cry.
Oh, that's right. You had your tear ducts removed.
Lobster. I have a better. So what about lobster screaming?
That's the worst sound ever. But then I ate it, and it tasted great.
You know why I eat veal? You know why I like veal so much?
Oh, why?
Love to taste the suffering.
Oh.
Love the suffering.
You are so bad.
It's tasty.
By the way, I have a real, like, the best animal story ever, and it happened last Friday. And nobody cares because it's a cat. But this black cat named Binks, who was on the ninth floor of that condo building, he rode it down. He rode the debris down.
Used all of his lives.
And three lives were lost during it. And he showed up 2 weeks later. And you know why?
Bink, is that you? I hear Bink.
It's a great story because they lost their father in that. And the mom and daughter actually survived too from the ninth floor. They rode it down. They were outside, so when it collapsed, they literally rode the debris down, escaped, and so did Binks. And they did not think they'd ever see Binks again. But people from the Humane Society, they set up food stations. Why are you laughing? They set up food stations around the building, hoping that some animals would come, and they found Binks.
That's going to be a Netflix movie.
It is.
It'll be a double feature with My Octopus Teacher. Also, this, too,
yes.
If you think the insect world is insulated from the purge, you'd be wrong. The gypsy moth will be getting a new name soon. The gypsy moth has been scrapped by the country's leading insect identification group. That's a fun group, the Entomological Society of America.
Right.
It's for wild parties. Because the moniker is an ethnic slur considered offensive by some Romani people.
Oh, right. You can't, well, you don't, I think it was 1999, Chicago police had a press conference and said, we are no longer using the term gypsies. They're Eastern European traveling groups because the gypsies were offended that Chicago police described them in that way.
Can you still use Wilbury to describe a traveling group? Like the traveling Wilburys, you know,
oh, yeah,
with George Harrison,
yeah,
Roy Orbison. Yeah. Now you're going to have to say, hey, instead of saying there's a gypsy moth in my closet, you're going to have to say there's a Lamantria dispar in my closet. They were dubbed gypsies because of, you know, the wandering nature of the Romani people. But scientists have theorized that it also comes from the tan color of the male moth. So that's identitarian in nature, but I thought identitarian is all the rage.
That's right, yeah.
I don't know. I'm confused about the heretofore Lamantra dispar name change. It reminds me of this. Maybe we'll just call it we'll just call it the insect that eats your clothes or something. You know, like we're calling the Washington football team.
Right. Well, they're going to come out with their new name soon.
In 2022.
It's not going to be the Warriors.
In 2022. Oh. 2021, they're sticking with WFT. It would have been better if they went with WTF.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we mentioned earlier in the program, for the first time in Chicago, some 911 calls for mental health emergencies won't be answered by police, but by mental health professionals paired with paramedics. It's a pilot program starting this fall. Paramedic will be dispatched with a mental health clinician for behavioral health calls. And another pilot, a paramedic, will work with a recovery specialist on calls involving substance abuse.
Hmm. Oh, my gosh. They have no idea what they're getting into. Have they even ever done a ride-along yet?
Well, Alex Heaton, who is Mayor Triple Threat's, their policy advisor for public safety.
And by the way, you did tweet out a picture of him.
Yeah, he's sort of like a fat Sideshow Bob, maybe a hairband refugee from the 80s.
He kind of looks like Sigourney Weaver, but a larger Sigourney Weaver who's transitioning.
Yeah.
But you know what? Let's not
When she was possessed in Ghostbusters?
Yeah.
Maybe like
kind of hard on this kid.
Like Dan Fogler from Balls of Fury.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe something like that.
He's just
something
trying
obscure.
To do the right thing, you know? They're so woke over there.
He's super excited about it.
Super excited.
Should Chicago residents be super excited about it? To help us with that question, we're pleased to be joined again by Rafael Mangual, who's a senior fellow and deputy director of legal policy at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research and contributing editor to City Journal. Rafael, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back there, Amy.
You heard what Chicago is piloting. Good idea. Should we be super excited about it?
I don't think it's something you necessarily should be super excited about. Definitely something we should keep a close eye on. I mean, we do have some interesting examples from around the country of similar initiatives that I don't want to say have necessarily worked, but have not been in total disasters. The sort of best example is the CAHOOTS program out in Eugene, Oregon, which is, you know, really a model for a lot of police departments that are trying to do the same thing. But one of the things that I think people don't quite fully appreciate is that even successful or semi-successful programs like CAHOOTS don't really have the capacity to deal with this problem in the same way that the police do. I'll give you a couple of quick numbers here. The CAHOOTS program, which you know, sort of reroutes certain calls to mental health professionals, community advocates, et cetera, away from police, that program was only able to cover just 17% of 911 calls. And in roughly one of every 67 calls that they initially answered, they had to call for police backup anyway. The reality is that there is not a jurisdiction in the country that has the ability or the means to answer every single call that would ideally be routed or rerouted to a mental health professional without using police. The number is just too high. I mean, if you look at, you know, New York City, I think we get, you know, hundreds of thousands of calls, you know, in a year. There aren't enough dedicated mental health professionals willing to work 24/7, which is, you know, when police are on. And when a lot of these calls come in, they often come in late at night or on the weekends. There just aren't enough to take this on.
Yeah. And by the way, the not a total disaster should not, I think, be the threshold for a particular program.
Exactly.
Or policy. Number one. Number two, Chicago is not Eugene, Oregon. Responding to a mental health issue in one of these shooting gallery neighborhoods is not the same thing as responding in sort of isolation to a relatively safe environment where you have somebody who's got a mental health issue. And it seems to me
that's exactly right.
Yeah, and just
that's
one more
exactly right.
Well, just one more point, and then I'll let you respond. It also seems to me that this is just completely reversed, as you're saying, building on what you were saying about police. Police, and then if you're flush with cash and you can afford to have a mental health clinician assigned to police officers or assigned to go along with police officers to a particular type of call, which Chicago isn't, but assuming that it were, okay, that's fine. But that's the right order. They've got the sequencing wrong.
I think that's right. You know, the two other points that I want to make here is one is that we've actually done analyses that have looked at how predictable 911 calls are in terms of what kind of call it's going to turn out to be. There's a really fantastic study out of Philadelphia, and what they found was that things that are eventually determined to be crimes can initially appear to a 911 dispatcher to be a public health related call, and vice versa. In fact, about 1 in 5 911 calls are not at all predictable from the nature of the information that was communicated to the dispatcher, which means that often you're going to have police showing up anyway because it's going to turn out to be just not the sort of situation in which you want a non-officer responder going to. The other point that I wanted to make is that I think people need to understand that this is not an initiative aimed at improving public safety. This is not a crime control measure, which is really what Chicago ought to be investing in at this time. I mean, last year, the city saw something like a 55% increase in homicides and shootings. There's no indication that there's going to be a drop off from that this year. Why this is where the money's going is beyond me. I mean, if I were making policy in the city of Chicago, I mean, one of the first things I would be doing is patching the hole in the police department because officers are leaving in droves.
Right. Well, what do they hope to accomplish? I mean, if you look at the big picture, we've had close to 2,000 shootings so far this year, and 8 have been police-involved shootings, and 3 of those ended fatally. So are they just hoping to thwart off any possibility of police brutality? Is that the end goal here?
That's exactly what this is about. This is about, you know, reducing, quote-unquote, police violence, even though we know from the data that police violence is an extraordinarily rare outcome of even the most fraught kind of police-citizen interactions, right? More than 99% of all arrests in the United States are effected without the use of physical force, any physical force whatsoever. And in the cases in which physical force is used, 98% of suspects walk away without any injury whatsoever. Police shootings are extraordinarily rare. We see intentional discharges by police of their firearms about 3,000 times a year, right around that. That if you look at, you know, the number of arrests that police are making in a year, about 10.3 million, you're talking about 0.003% of all arrests ending with a police shooting, the vast majority of which are justified. So, you know, the idea that we have this massive police violence problem that we need to solve is just wrong. What we do have is a massive violent crime problem that we're not doing nearly enough about.
You know, if I was a Chicago police officer, I'd be championing this program. Hey, 36 Chicago cops have been shot so far this year, and it's only July. Hey, great. Yeah, you want to respond to these calls that I don't have to, you know, put somebody else on the line and see how they like not being backed up by the civilian political authorities. I mean, it's a sad commentary, but I mean, when it's every man for himself and you don't have the political backing that you need to be effective, then why put yourself in harm's way if you don't have to?
Right, right. The problem is, though, is that at least if any other programs that are similar across the country are any indication, police are still going to get called to a ton of these scenes,
right,
irrespective of this program.
Right.
Right? It's been shown time and again that a significant percentage of these calls result in requests for backup from armed officers. So it's not like they're going to be totally relieved of this burden. And that's problematic because, you know, I think the Chicago Police Department has been sending some mixed signals to its rank and file. I mean, the foot pursuit policy, a new policy on tasers, I think officers are rightly feeling exasperated about what it is that they are going to have support from the city on. And, you know, it's a recipe for disaster. That's what the city, I think, ought to be concentrating on more.
Let me get your take on something else in the city in Chicago. More than 50 Chicago public schools have until next Wednesday to decide if they want to continue the school resource officer program. And what is your perspective on having police in schools, having a school resource officer in schools, particularly in schools in high crime neighborhoods? And I say that against a backdrop where it's not that long ago, after, you know, terrible massacres like Parkland, where we were talking about how to harden schools and so on and so forth. And now, because of the left's defund the police movement, now we're talking about stripping schools of police presence.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the same. It's out of the same playbook. So, you know, what happens is you get a viral incident of a school resource officer using force on camera in a way that doesn't look good. People seize on that to argue that this is actually, you know, part of a broader trend when the data don't support that argument at all. And then they move to deprive schools in high crime areas that could actually use school resource officers of those resources. So, you know, again, I'd be happy to be corrected if I'm wrong. But so far as I'm aware, there is not a school resource officer violence problem. Force is not particularly likely. Serious charges and arrests are not particularly common. So, yeah, it's just a solution in search of a problem.
And it's really aimed at serving.
Well, the one school that did have an alleged, you know, police brutality case, it turned their LSC voted to keep their officers in school. And I know our LSC voted to keep our officers in, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's
I'm glad. I like the extra protection.
The schools leading the way in terms of dumping police are, of course,
Jones
the
Prep.
Schools, yeah, Champagne Socialist
Jones
Kids.
Prep.
Jones
yeah.
Prep, for example.
Jesse Sharkey's son goes there. They don't need, so they're going to use that $50,000 to put equity chairman of student body in.
You know,
ridiculous.
It's one of those things where it's so insulting because you have the luxury of safety, and so you can signal, you know, your solidarity with the Marxists, whereas, you know, schools in the shooting galleries on the west and south side of Chicago, you know, they don't have that luxury, at least not if you're interested in protecting kids.
That's exactly right. I mean, you see that, you know, with criminal justice policy more broadly, in which, you know, some of the sort of fiercest, most progressive advocates for large-scale decarceration and depolicing are not actually in a place in which they're going to bear any of the risks that are associated with those kinds of policy initiatives, right? Crime, violent crime especially, is extraordinarily concentrated in the United States in places like, you know, Inglewood, Austin, Humboldt Park, et cetera, you know, West Garfield Park. It's not, you know, a national problem. It's not even a citywide problem, even in a place like Chicago.
Yeah.
So the idea that, you know, progressives living in, you know, safe enclaves and nearby suburbs, you know, ought to be driving policy, you know, it does frustrate me a little bit as someone, you know, who has family on the west side of Chicago, who, you know, grew up in a neighborhood at a time in which the streets were not particularly safe. I think we would do better if more people had a more realistic idea of what life is actually like in high crime neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mean even Eric Adams, you know, the Democrat nominee for mayor of New York City, saying we need to be a little less idealistic and a little bit more realistic when it comes to keeping people safe. Rafael Manguel, Senior Fellow and Deputy Director of Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research and a contributing editor at City Journal as well. Rafael, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and this is right in your wheelhouse, Amy.
Yeah.
An op-ed from New York Post's Zachary Kusin. Isolated for months in my upstate hometown, I spent the pandemic baking, overeating, and gaining about 20 pounds above the 190 I weighed in 2019. I eventually trimmed down to 175, but I was reluctant to share my weight loss on social media for fear of offending anyone.
What?
On social media, it is now popular
to
bash diets for being insensitive to those who are fat asses. So you can't, I mean, I'm, you know, that's my description of it. He says being insensitive to those with eating disorders or fat asses is what I think he's trying to get to. And so, yeah, this is no joke. You can't
the thing.
You can't talk about diets, or you can't say, look at, you know, you can't do the Jenny Craig. Look at my pants where they used to be
before and
now look
pants.
At me after. Because
why not?
That's,
I love
that's
those
shaming
stories.
That's shaming fat asses. That's shaming J.B. Pritzker. And other fat asses.
I mean, he's got all the money in the world. Why wouldn't he get his stomach stapled or something?
Maybe he likes being a fat ass.
He obviously is choosing that path.
Yeah.
Because he gained weight during the pandemic.
Did he?
Yeah.
How can you tell?
Because I saw him more than my mother. I saw him every day. And then when I see him for a week, he'd get, you know.
I think isn't when you're morbidly obese, like historically morbidly obese, like J.B. Pritzker, isn't it like losing weight? Like you have to lose a lot of weight for anybody to notice. You'd have to gain a lot of weight for anybody to notice when you're a square.
Right, yeah.
Don't you think?
Well, speaking of overweight people, Stacey Abrams, she's up
don't you
for...
Don't you diet shame her.
No. She's up for an Emmy.
For being a fat ass?
For her appearance on Black-ish. When Anthony, you know, the character that plays Anthony Anderson, when he was considering a run for Congress.
Running for office is a lot of work, mostly fundraising. To beat the big money you're up against, you'll need community support. Knock on doors, talk at churches and union meetings.
And that'll be enough?
Oh, definitely not. So I can't imagine you pulling it off.
I was looking for more of a pep talk.
You've lost weight?
Well, thank you, Stacey Abrams. Wait a second. How would you know? We just met.
Wow. She really
hit it home. I mean, Cuomo better watch out.
She's a natural. She really dominates the screen, you know, because, well, she's a fat ass.
But she's nominated for an Emmy for that?
Oh, it's gripping performance. It wasn't tin at all. It wasn't tinny at all.
Here's another.
She's so natural. It's so conversational.
I'm so happy to be talking to you today about mail-in voting.
What? I thought we were talking about my campaign.
I may have lied to both of you, but since we're here...
It's just insufferable.
Obviously, that fat ass went to the Stanislavski school. I mean, it's just so good. Okay.
An Emmy. And that's going to be awarded during prime time.
Don't be talking about your yoga. And by the way, two things that never lie.
What?
Five-year-olds in yoga pants.
Thanks so much for making this part of your morning. It is 9 a.m. WIND Chicago.